Welcome to this episode of Real Space Strategy. I'm your host, Christopher Stone, Senior Fellow for Space Deterrence and Warfighting at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies in Washington, D.C. Real Space Strategy exists to provide you, the listener, a reality check on U.S. space policy and strategy, while giving you insight into the processes required to achieve a credible deterrent and warfighting posture for the United States Space Force. The views expressed by the host and guests in Real Space Strategy are those of the host and guests and are not to be attributed or considered part of any government entity or private sector company. Recently, in numerous editorials, articles, and social media posts, many have been either hailing the astronauts' recovery as a rescue from being stuck or stranded on the International Space Station for 9 months, or, on the other side, criticizing the quote-unquote lies about this event not being such a rescue, and it's all a big political stunt. On a different article, a different note about NASA, many are now complaining about the Trump administration's consideration of possibly moving most or some of NASA headquarters functions from Washington, D.C. to among the various NASA centers across the country. Both stories are lacking in some very important information that I'd like to share with you today. Hopefully, having this information that you likely won't see or hear anywhere else will prove enlightening and helpful to you, both as citizens and as space strategy fans. So let's start with topic one, the return of the Starliner astronauts from an extra 9 months in space. So since the return of the astronauts, Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, there have been copious articles and videos decrying the, quote, lies from the president and Elon Musk about the rescuing of the astronauts from being stranded on the space station. I think it's imperative to understand that a few things these authors who are clearly invested in either narrative might leave out. So, first argument that you might have heard in the news is, quote, the astronauts were not stuck or stranded. They had a ride home all along, end quote. Okay, so this is one that seems kind of obvious, but perhaps it's not. When astronauts were ordered to stay on board and watch their Boeing Starliner ship they were trained to test fly go home unmanned, it is true that they would have had a ride home eventually. However, they flew up on a Boeing ship with Boeing spacesuits. These suits did not fit in a Russian Soyuz or SpaceX Crew Dragon life support system. Both were the only vehicles docked to the station. Therefore, for the months that they were up there without a Crew Dragon suit, which came up later, the astronauts were in fact stuck. Also, when the new Dragon came up months later with the suits, they were told that it was not their ride home. They had to wait until Crew 10 showed up months later. So when Crew 8 went home, instead of riding back with two of those people and leaving those two Crew 9 ISS astronauts on board, they decided to keep Butch and Sonny up. So here's an analogy to help with us understand this whole stuck, not stuck thing. So let's say you have driven out into the middle of nowhere in a Chevy. You have the keys for the Chevy. You know all about that car, and you've driven it over and over again. You're very well trained and familiar with it. But it breaks down, and it ends up being towed away. Yet there is a loaner car left for you. But you don't have the keys for that, yet you make it work. And you try, and it's not your car. So the dealership says, just stay there, we will bring you the keys. So you sit around for hours and hours and hours, and while you wait, you may have a ride home sitting there, but you can't use it. The people who own it say you can't go anywhere until they get there, and frankly, you don't have the key, so it won't work even if you tried. That was essentially the situation for the two astronauts. They didn't have the keys and the freedom to just get in and go home in their ride whenever they wanted. They had to wait until they were allowed to go home and that they had the right equipment to do so. So that, in the car situation, would be called, by anybody, stranded or stuck in anyone's vocabulary. But instead, NASA changed their mission from being a test flight to being a part of the station crew so that they had something constructive to do. This is not what they were trained for. But they had been there twice before in various other missions, so it would make time go by a little bit quicker doing something useful. But I would say it's true, they were stuck. They were stranded. The only time they would have left in that 9 month period was if they had to evacuate or on another ride by SpaceX if they were to send one up just for them. More on that in a bit. Argument number two you might have heard is that SpaceX offered a trip home, but the Biden administration and NASA rejected it. Now, the astronauts did their dead level best to stay out of this political back and forth, but their quotation recently that what Mr. Musk said is accurate, quote unquote, was the biggest hint that Elon Musk was not making it up. Musk really has no incentive to make up a story that they offered to come for a period of time way less than 9 months to get the astronauts down. It wouldn't hurt, it wouldn't help his business to be such of that situation. But so the astronauts could have been brought down by a SpaceX crew dragging way earlier than 9 months. How could this have happened? Well, there were stories reported, for those that may not remember, about how the soon-to-be new NASA administrator, Jared Isaacman, who has flown two SpaceX missions that he paid for himself, would pilot one extra Dragon up and bring back the astronauts themselves. But instead, that never was given the okay. While it is true that all the docking ports were taken up by two SpaceX Crew Dragons, there is precedent for vehicles to move around when a new ship comes up. There was one time, for example, during a Shuttle Mir docking mission in the 90s, where a Soyuz undocked at the same time a shuttle was set to leave to ensure video and photos were taken. SpaceX could have sent up Isaacman, trained in the vehicle that he's quite aware of from flying it twice, to the International Space Station. The current crew could undock one of the Dragons, move out of the way, allow the rescue ship to dock, onboard the two Boeing test astronauts, undock again, and the space station crew could redock while the other one goes home. That decision was rejected. Why? Because, as Musk argues, it was a political decision, not a capability-based decision. This is covered in the next argument that people are hearing, but just suffice it to say, with this specific instance, it was considered easier to leave them there till the next crew increment transfer. They also argued that they were delayed because of Crew Dragon's new version not being ready for Crew 10, but because of the situation with the two astronauts and some other items that were going on, including a change in administration, that became a non-issue later anyway, and they flew an older version. So moving on, argument three you might have heard. Quote, they were safer not to fly back on Boeing's worthless spacecraft. They could have died on reentry, but this is not a political decision. It's an engineering and safety decision. Okay. So these two crew members, Butch and Sonny, consisted of an experienced test pilot astronaut and an experienced flight test engineer astronaut. Both had flown different spacecraft into space several times and numerous aircraft. They all flew on Space Shuttle, Soyuz, and now Boeing CST-100 Starliner, which launched up on an Atlas V. And by the way, for those history buffs interested, the last time an American rode to orbit on an Atlas was the last Mercury mission piloted by Gordon Cooper in the early 1960s. As flight test professionals and veteran astronauts, they were highly trained and knew what their mission entailed, testing a new ship. The ship had consistently had issues over the last decade and was delayed considerably from its contracted timeline. Once they finally got into space, the spacecraft started having issues with thrusters and other items important to getting safely to the space station and back home. These two, with the help of Boeing controllers in Houston, were able to work the issues and brought the spaceship into a smooth docking with the space station. Once there, the teams of NASA and Boeing wanted to work the issues to be sure that they understood the problems well before bringing them back, so they were extended several weeks beyond the 8-day test flight. The reports in the press about Boeing and NASA management folks being in vehement disagreement with each other on whether the two trained test pilot astronauts could safely fly it back were clear that there was more going on than simply engineering concerns. What do I mean by that? Well, when the NASA administrator, in this case President Biden's appointees, former Senator Bill Nelson, engaged himself into most of the press events and commentary, sometimes wearing an astronaut flight jacket, which for me was very irritating, and maybe in another episode I can get into that as why. But whenever that senior of a leader, a political appointee, is engaged in such instances, it's a clear indicator that the DC policy sphere is very involved in these discussions, and it's not simply an engineering or flight safety issue. It was a presidential election year as well, and the vice president, the leading candidate for their party, who also happened to be the chair of the National Space Council, was included. The whole episode was obviously embarrassing for NASA and Boeing, and in some political circles, Congress, for example, people were questioning the entire program and the leadership of the agency and the council. If the two test astronauts were to die on reentry over New Mexico, its landing site, there was political ramifications, to be sure, not just safety or engineering decisions at stake. So likely there were political issues included in the decision to not fly back with crew, and that does make sense. A lot of people are really upset about, oh, we need to get politics out of the space program. But the thing is, NASA, much to people's dismay, is a government agency ran by political appointees. And as such, it is not and never has been a nonpartisan entity. The White House Council, the National Space Council, leads the policy that eventually becomes a space flight or an operation. And I can tell you with certainty that given the NASA administrator's heavy engagement and the vice president's relative silence on the issue, the decision to keep them on the space station was a political decision, at least somewhat. One that makes sense, again, it makes sense from a political standpoint, but I'm not sure if it makes sense from a test flying standpoint. I don't have all the info on the technical issues and things beyond that, but I've been around long enough in the space world to know what it means when the administrator is in everyone's faces. He's definitely interested and concerned. So was it a rescue mission? Not exactly. Were they stranded? Yeah. Was their mission changed? Absolutely. Should it have been? Well, I personally think the evidence shows it was not necessary, but it was a decision that was made. And people will continue to argue about it, but these are at least some of the facts that were not readily reported by the press and the former administration. They did not need to stay up there 9 months, though, in my opinion, when a viable rescue ship was available. Given SpaceX's flight rate, show that they could have readied a ride home in a few months rather than 9. So it is highly likely, as with other decisions in this situation, that political concerns were a big part of things, not just safety. And as long as NASA remains a government agency, this is just a fact of life. So keep that in mind. So topic number two, NASA again. This one is about moving NASA headquarters functions elsewhere in the United States. So according to Politico, NASA is considering rather closing its headquarters and scattering responsibilities of the headquarters among the various NASA centers across the country. Quote, "a move that has the potential to dilute its coordination and influence in Washington," end quote, the Politico article states. According to another article, quote, "the overhaul of the space agency, according to two people familiar with the plan, seeks to adhere to the Trump administration's desire to cut federal spending. The proposal could affect up to 2,500 jobs and redistribute critical functions, including who manages space exploration and organizes major science missions," end quote. The story also adds, quote, "the move would also end jockeying between space-focused states to house the headquarters." And what they're talking about is there have been Florida senators and other political folks from Ohio and other states that have been saying, bring headquarters to Cleveland at a Glenn Center, or you need to come down to Alabama, or come down to Kennedy Space Center. Okay, so here's a few items that most folks might not know about NASA. Yes, they do have a DC-based headquarters building. It's been there since the beginning in 1958, where the senior political staff and other engineers and support folks work, such as NASA administrator, deputy, etc. They have a public affairs shop. They have a legislative affairs shop for dealing and working with the Congress and other things that most departments and agencies in DC have. Now, what you might not know is all of the NASA centers across the country do not just funnel themselves up the chain of command to do whatever NASA headquarters says. In fact, all the NASA centers are organized and view themselves in many respects as little independent agencies in their own right. They also have their directors, their own public affairs, and yes, they have a legislative affairs team to engage their local congressional and Senate delegations. So how might this create issues? Well, it happened where instead of following the decisions made by the White House and NASA headquarters on something, so let's say a program is going to be cut or the center closure, they want to realign things, the Senate director and his or her legislative team will engage with the local congressman and work to defend their center or programs and local jobs from their own bosses in Washington, D.C. Then when the Space Subcommittee or another committee in Congress has a hearing, and the NASA administrator or their subordinates get an earful of questions and accusations because the centers have been engaging in this sort of counterinsurgency type of bureaucratic activity, this can be seen to be the case more often than not. And if you want to read a book about this and how such things work, there's a book by Thor Hogan called Mars Wars on why the Space Exploration Initiative of the George H.W. Bush administration went nowhere. And part of it was because of the competition between headquarters and the various NASA centers in Congress and elsewhere. So it's highly possible, given the push to save budget money and move it elsewhere from buildings and staff to programs and actual space activities and missions, that this situation, this history of how the centers and the headquarters have functioned, is known by the current administration, and therefore they are looking for ways of fixing the situation, or at least maybe leveraging the situation for the benefit of the agency and maybe even the country. There have been many proposed ways to, quote, fix NASA over the last several decades, to include everything from a private board of directors to increasing the term of a NASA administrator to nearly a decade from 4 years. So while this is just a trial balloon in my mind, it does have some context and thought behind it. And if the congressional staffers and members won't allow them to close and realign centers, which has been attempted in the past by other administrations, why not then move all the DC-based stuff, with a minor team staying behind for some critical functions, to the various centers across the country who, as I mentioned, have duplicative capabilities bureaucratically anyway, with some of the functions at NASA headquarters, and then integrate them better under the administrator's leadership. Now, we shall see what happens on this, but from my experience, NASA is one of the most congressionally micromanaged agencies in the executive branch. Reforms, even good ones, will be hard to get through the process. However, it's not impossible, and a lot of things could change. This depends on who's in charge of the committees and how many votes they can get and what the budget is like. So I thought you might like to know a little bit about these two stories, which have been getting a lot of airtime on the radio and TV. And I hope that you will find it useful to you as citizens and, again, fellow space nerds. So for now, this is Christopher Stone from Real Space Strategy. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Real Space Strategy. Real Space Strategy with Christopher Stone is a production of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And for more information, see us at our website, thinkdeterrence.com. That's thinkdeterrence.com, our YouTube page, and any of our various social media sites on whichever platform you choose.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.